Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, Code Red, the latest United Nations report, finds time is running out to avoid catastrophic outcomes from human-caused climate change. Also, despite the virus outbreak still raging in New South Wales, the Premier is flagging that some restrictions can ease in less than 3 weeks. And what can be changed at the family court to better deal with child abuse allegations?
The cases which go to trial in the family court are the too hard basket of the child protection system. They're the cases where the police don't feel they're able to prosecute, the child protection authorities haven't reached a clear view of whether abuse has occurred.
A stark warning tonight that humans have caused irreparable climate change, locking in more extreme and more frequent climate events, as scientists find that global warming is likely to surge past a 1.5 degrees Celsius rise a decade sooner than previously forecast, likely by the mid-2030s. It is the key finding of the latest report from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, signed off by the panel's 195 member countries. And it's all happening because the world has not done enough, the report says, to curb damaging carbon emissions. More than 200 scientists contribute, laying out the latest science ahead of the next climate summit in Glasgow in November, where Australia's contested carbon reduction promises will be under new pressure. Here's Inga Anderson, the Executive Director of the United Nations Environment Programme, releasing the report this evening.
You've been telling us for over three decades of the dangers of allowing the planet to warm. The world listened, but didn't hear. The world listened, but it didn't act strongly enough. And as a result, climate change is a problem that is here now. Nobody's safe, and it's getting worse faster. We must treat climate change as an immediate threat, just as we must treat the connected crisis of nature and biodiversity loss and pollution and waste as immediate threats.
Well, Dr. Sarah Perkins Kirkpatrick is a climate scientist, a chief investigator at the ARC Centre of Excellence for Climate Extremes, and a senior lecturer at the University of New South Wales in Canberra.
It is quite concerning, but unfortunately not expected based on, you know, recent events that we've seen in the observational record. And it just unfortunately means that the climate is warming more rapidly than what we had originally thought when the last IPCC report was written, and that the impacts associated with that warming occurring more early or earlier will occur earlier themselves.
So when we look to the Northern Hemisphere right now and see these incredible temperatures and incredible fires sweeping, you know, whole continents, are we seeing climate change? Does this report tell us that?
Absolutely. So in any of these events that we're seeing now, especially the extreme temperature events, there is absolutely a signal of climate change behind those events. That goes for the events that we saw in Australia a couple of years ago during our Black Summer, what happened in Canada recently, and also what's going on in Greece and Turkey at the moment. So in some of these cases, climate variability has also been an important driver, but climate change as well has been a very important driver there too. So more events like these, you know, are going to occur more often now.
And for Australia, the implications for us?
Yeah, look, I hate to say, but it's not looking great. So with every degree warming, that means that extremes wherever you are in the world are going to increase in their frequency and or severity, depending on the type of extreme. So in Australia, we're already prone to heat waves, really bad bushfires, and in some places, bad droughts as well. And unfortunately, per level of global warming, the frequency and severity of heat waves will increase. That's undoubtable. We're more likely to see severe bushfires. And in some places, we'll see much more intense droughts, particularly in southern Australia.
What does it tell us about the certainty of the cause of global warming?
So the IPCC report process has actually been going on for about three decades now. The first report came back all the way back in 1990. And with each successive report, the confidence and the certainty around these statements has increased. And not only that, we've had more and more scientists participate in the reports, and also more and more scientific literature has been reviewed internal to the report. This confidence behind the science and the overwhelming amount of evidence that we have is showing that climate change is happening, and the vast majority of it is because of our activities. On top of that, we need to act urgently to limit warming as much as we possibly can. And unfortunately, that means something like reaching a 1.5 degree threshold and stabilizing at that, or even 2 degrees Celsius. That's not really that feasible anymore. It's not completely off the table, but it's looking more and more unlikely as each year progresses.
So going into the next climate change conference in November in Glasgow, what does the world need to do in order to try to get rein this in, you know, to a useful degree for humans?
Well, in that way, the message of the IPCC report hasn't changed. We need to act quickly and urgently and drastically to reduce our emissions. That level of urgency has increased because we simply haven't done enough to limit catastrophic climate change.
And Australia, of course, has had a very difficult climate change policy debate. This government has been reluctant to shift its policy. What will Australia need to do at this next conference to do our bit for this?
Gosh, well, we need to be serious about what we're doing to reduce our emissions as a country. We haven't done much. It's almost like that the IPCC findings, as well as findings by other separate climate scientists, has been completely ignored. And we can't do that anymore. We shouldn't have been doing that in the first place, let alone over the last three decades. So we really need to pull our heads out of the sand and really mean what we're going to do in terms of reducing emissions and do more of it.
Sarah Perkins Kirkpatrick, thank you very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
UNSW climate scientist Dr. Sarah Perkins Kirkpatrick. New ammunition is going to be going into the COVID vaccine armoury here, because today Moderna's vaccine has been given the provisional green light by Australian authorities. It's encouraging news as the outbreak in New South Wales continues unabated, though the Premier is promising eased restrictions by the end of August if the uptake of existing vaccines is high enough. But one of Australia's leading epidemiologists has warned that approach will put too many people in hospital if it leads to an easing of lockdowns too soon. Isabel Rowe reports.
Week 7 of lockdown in Greater Sydney, and the COVID crisis may yet get worse.
There were 283 cases of community transmission, with at least 64 of them infectious for that time in the community.
The New South Wales Premier, Gladys Berejiklian, is urging compliance with stay-at-home orders as the virus epicentre settles on the Canterbury-Bankstown region in Western Sydney. But she's so far resisted a call from the country's Chief Medical Officer, Paul Kelly, for a circuit breaker, a further tightening of lockdown measures. Instead, she's promising an easing of restrictions as vaccination rates increase.
Once you hit 70% of vaccinations, we will be changing the way we think about the virus. We'll be talking about hospitalisation rather than cases, and we have to start thinking about that now.
Gladys Berejiklian wants 6 million shots in arms by the end of August. That would see about half the adult population in the state receive the vaccine. At that point, she says, the government will consider what sectors could reopen.
The two priorities for the government are to get face-to-face learning back and also getting people back to work. And both of those things will have positive benefits. Families struggling to work at home or work from home, but also teach their kids at home. I can't imagine what that would be like. But obviously, when people are allowed to go back to work, that means the industry they work in is also providing services to customers.
But advisor to the World Health Organization, UNSW epidemiologist Professor Mary Louise McClaws, thinks while most under 16s aren't eligible for vaccination, that's a dangerous plan.
We will put too many people in hospital if we're going to open up at 50% of the adult population. The adult population represents 80% of the total population. So 70% of 80% is basically 56% of the total population. So you're looking at nearly every one in every second person is not protected.
Mary Louise McClaws is highly critical of the modelling adopted by the federal government, which suggests easing restrictions for vaccinated people once vaccination rates reach 70% of over 16s.
So if they started to lift restrictions at 70% of the adult population, we'd have a fourth wave.
The modelling the federal government is relying on has been done by the Doherty Institute. Epidemiologists there believe a vaccination rate of 70% will effectively reduce the Delta variant's ability to transmit to others. While vaccination rates are increasing in Greater Sydney, New South Wales Health says it's trying to boost availability in the regions. A COVID-positive person has travelled from Newcastle, north of Sydney, to Tamworth, sparking a seven-day snap lockdown for that region. Member for Tamworth, Kevin Anderson, has told locals COVID testing is being increased.
There are long waits. So we do advise that you do take care of yourself, take any medication or food, sometimes up to 5 or 6 hours are the wait times.
Another positive case went to Byron Bay in the state's north. The Byron Shire, Richmond Valley, Lismore and Ballina Shire local government areas are headed into lockdown tonight.
Isabel Rowe with that report. Well, residents in regional Victoria are just hours away from enjoying some new freedoms, while those in metro Melbourne continue to watch new case numbers, hoping their lockdown will be lifted on Thursday. As we've heard, the New South Wales Premier is holding out the promise of an easing of restrictions on condition of higher vaccination rates. But the Victorian and Queensland premiers remain resolute on the need for hard borders and tough restrictions while vaccine supplies remain constrained. Daniel Andrews reminded his New South Wales counterpart today about the agreements reached at National Cabinet about exactly when opening up can occur. Emily Burke reports.
11 new cases for Melbourne today, and all are linked to the existing outbreak, which now stands at 56 cases. And with the outbreak largely contained to the city and suburbs, there'll be an early mark from lockdown for the residents of regional Victoria.
After 4 days of lockdown and no cases in regional Victoria will be released from these lockdown measures from 11:59pm tonight.
Hospitality, retail, gyms and schools will reopen and people will be able to leave home for any reason. But the Premier says no decision on lockdown has been made for Melburnians who must stay put.
There's no point going to regional Victoria. You won't be able to buy so much as a litre of milk without establishing that you're from regional Victoria. So no one from Melbourne should be going to the regions unless they have a valid reason. People from regional Victoria can travel through Melbourne to get to another part of regional Victoria, but they need to use common sense and good judgment.
The origin of this latest Delta outbreak is Sydney, but it's not clear how or when it started. And Premier Andrews has again called for tighter restrictions on Greater Sydney.
That's where a ring of steel should be put on. That's my view. I've made that view, whether it's popular or whether people like me putting that view. You know, tough. There should be a ring of steel around Sydney. Then we wouldn't have to be defending our border as much as we are. But that's the decision of the New South Wales government.
And he's rejected a softer, nuanced alternative to the current lockdown in Melbourne.
Whether it's sustainable or not, it's the only option we have. And that's the agreed National Cabinet position. Every Premier, every Chief Minister, the PM, all the health experts tell us that with Delta, there's no option. And again, I'm not here to be a commentator on Sydney. If you want to see whether locking down some local government areas works, have a look what's happening up there. We tried that last year. It didn't work against last year's coronavirus, let alone against Delta.
We are absolutely concerned about what's happening in New South Wales.
Further north, the Queensland Premier issued a warning to her New South Wales counterpart.
So we already have those border patrols and those border controls in place at present. But if we have to go harder, we will. We can go harder by, you know, it would have to be stopping everybody. We are very concerned at the moment. We're not at that stage, but if we have to go harder, we will.
Oh, look, I can't control what other state premiers and chief ministers do, and they've demonstrated their propensity to close borders to us.
The New South Wales Premier, Gladys Berejiklian.
But at the moment now, nobody from New South Wales can travel anywhere anyway. So isn't it better for our citizens, for our health and safety and our well-being, to fight for our citizens, to have those freedoms? And I remember other states closing borders to us when we had very low numbers of cases that weren't even Delta. So I think it's pretty predictable what the other states will do. I don't know about you guys, but I don't think any state premier is going to change their position on that.
But the Victorian Premier, Daniel Andrews, has reiterated the National Cabinet deal on the conditions for opening up.
We have an agreed National Cabinet framework, and that is that they can't open up, nobody can open up and move to the next phase until we're all at 70%. Then there'll be further steps to take as a nation once we're to 80%. We're all of us, because of supply, we're all a long way away from those numbers.
Victoria's Premier Daniel Andrews, Emily Burke reporting. Well, as lockdowns roll on around the country, the Deputy Prime Minister, Barnaby Joyce, says he sympathises with businesses that want to make COVID vaccination compulsory for their employees. Mr. Joyce is himself now caught up in lockdown in northern New South Wales and has been forced to miss Parliament this week as a result. He says he understands why many in the community are frustrated and angry with the government and isn't surprised the coalition trails the opposition in major opinion polls. Here's political reporter James Glenday.
Thanks, Mr. Speaker. My question's to the Prime Minister. Will the government rule out economic incentives for vaccinations?
Parliament's back in Canberra, and once again, the pandemic is the only real issue on the agenda, with the opposition leader Anthony Albanese spending much of his day attacking the Prime Minister over the slow vaccine rollout.
Mr. Speaker, what we'll rule out is bad ideas, Mr. Speaker. That's what we'll rule out.
Members on
we'll rule out bad ideas.
Scott Morrison continues to reject Labor's idea of offering $300 to all Australians who get vaccinated by the start of December. It's a rare proposal that's gained traction in the tabloid media and sparked debate on talkback radio, much to the annoyance of several members of the government, as it comes at a time when large swathes of the population is locked down, including now the Deputy Prime Minister.
So kept in close contact with ACT Health via my office, and sure enough, they said, if you want to come to Canberra, then you get to stay at your own expense in a hotel for 14 days. Didn't think that was a good idea.
Barnaby Joyce was denied entry to Canberra after stay-at-home orders were imposed in Armidale in northern New South Wales. Now he's working remotely from a car on his family's farm.
The advantage I've got is we've got a property. In certain areas of that property, you get good mobile service, 4G service. So I just drive to the ridge where I think I can get it and make my calls from there.
From one of those ridges, he told the ABC he particularly sympathises with businesses that are struggling right now around the nation. And he'd understand if they wanted to make their employees get a COVID-19 vaccination as a condition of returning to work.
I think private enterprise has a greater right or a greater logic to say, unless you're intending to pay my insurance bill, my rates bill, my wages bill, my deep cleaning if something goes wrong, then I need to get vaccinated so I can get back to making a dollar as quickly as possible.
Do you think the government should support those people if they get sued? Because there's a risk.
I suppose there is. And this is a test case. I don't know whether how big that liability would be. And you've got to be really, really careful in this job that you don't say, oh, I think the government should support that. And then later on find out it comes with a price tag of multiple billions of dollars.
Business lobby groups want much clearer direction and support than that from the Commonwealth. Last week, state and territory leaders decided they'd leave it up to individual companies to decide whether to force their workers to get a jab. Ines Willicks from the Australian Industry Group says employers will get tied up in the courts unless there's government intervention.
This has sort of been like a ping pong ball between health and safety when it comes to policy setting in government. And business now starts to need to get some clear directions. They're going to go on their own, and we're going to run. And business is going to run into lawsuits and claims around discrimination and privacy and the like. We're already seeing overseas a lot of businesses just basically starting to make decisions to offload employees who decline to get vaccinated. And that's going to be a test here.
But some on the government backbench think it's a bit early to have this conversation, given parts of the population haven't had a chance to get vaccinated yet. Liberal Senator James Patterson says different industries are also likely to have different requirements.
There are some businesses where it will be obviously necessary, like aged care and other healthcare settings. But businesses need to carefully consider beyond that whether or not it is reasonably necessary for them to operate their business safely to mandate it of their workers.
The opposition's health spokesman, Mark Butler, says it would be good if unions, business groups and the government could all agree on a plan.
There are complex issues to work through in the workplace, and these issues are simply not going to disappear. Scott Morrison should be sitting down now with business and with unions to work through these workplace vaccination issues. But the issue today, of course, is one of supply. Too many people who want a vaccine simply can't get it.
The coalition is very sensitive to criticism about vaccine supply, and this afternoon the Prime Minister held a press conference to announce a new COVID-19 vaccine has been approved for use.
The Therapeutic Goods Administration has given provisional approval for the use of Moderna for Australians aged 18 years and over. We will have 10 million of the Moderna doses arriving before the end of this year. The first 1 million doses is on track to arrive next month and will go to pharmacies.
But the opposition says the announcement again only serves to highlight that Australia is behind in its rollout, given Moderna is already in use in other parts of the world.
Political reporter James Glenday from Canberra. Well, for much of the pandemic, communities in far north Queensland have lived in a before times bubble. QR code check-in at venues only started a month ago, and masks were something only Sydney and Melbourne folks wore. But now Cairns and the nearby Aboriginal community of Yarrabah are in a three-day lockdown after a taxi driver tested COVID positive during the weekend. So how well equipped are health facilities in that area for this reminder that COVID spares no one? Carly Williams reports.
On the traditional land of the Gungunji people is the Aboriginal community of Yarrabah. Indigenous primary health care physician Dr. Jason King runs the local health service in the community. It is considered remote, but it's only half an hour away from the city of Cairns.
The main community is on this beautiful crescent beach lined with palm trees. It looks out over the reef and you can see Cairns across the water from mountains in the background, rainforest. It's a, yeah, it's really a beautiful, fantastic, special place. Yeah.
But with little warning at all, Yarrabah, along with Cairns, has been plunged into a three-day lockdown after a COVID-positive case, a taxi driver, was infectious in the Cairns community for 10 days. Queensland contact tracers have linked the cab driver to a Marine Reef pilot who tested positive last week. The pilot had caught the infected taxi driver's cab to the airport for a job. Queensland Chief Health Officer Dr. Jeanette Young says the race is now on for contact tracers to figure out if the virus has spread throughout Cairns.
It's vital that you are now in lockdown for 3 days while we work out all the contacts of this taxi driver and we go back and reassess all the contacts of that pilot who brings ships in through the reef.
In Yarrabah, day one of the lockdown hasn't exactly been a breeze.
Today, the first day of lockdown has been a huge challenge for us in the clinic. We, for the first time in a long time, have managed to get to full 7 doctors on our staff. And today we're down to essentially 1.5, if you include myself. So it is a challenge. We've got 5 to 6 doctors away, either getting tests because they have symptoms or they've been, you know, close contacts of the case.
It's not ideal for Dr. Jason King, who provides healthcare for about 3,500 people in Yarrabah.
And we run a very busy clinic. Even on a day like today, we've got myself and another doctor who are fully booked out, plus seeing extras and phone consults, the fever clinic next door at the emergency department, and then our vaccination clinics.
AstraZeneca arrived in Yarrabah in March. The rollout was gangbusters for the first 10 days and then, like many other places in Australia, hit a snag.
Our vaccine program really suffered, I think, due to the kind of changes in advice and the community response to AstraZeneca. And we've been sort of managing the changes in the advice from the Atagi around that, flowing on that information to the community so that they can have access to the right vaccine for them.
Pfizer arrived in Yarrabah just 4 weeks ago. About 86 people in the community have both shots. By the end of the week, Dr. Jason King wants 1,000 people of the 3,500 folks in the community with at least one jab. But for Indigenous healthcare workers on the ground, the current restrictions just highlight the disadvantage faced by First Nations communities every day.
It does have a distinct lack of housing at its core. We've only got 350 houses here for those 3,500 people. So when we're talking to people and asking them to isolate, that is it's a physical impossibility.
4 new local COVID cases have been detected in southeast Queensland as that region emerges from an 8-day lockdown. Cairns has been left hanging on an update if there's been any cases linked to the taxi driver. State Labor MP Michael Healy says we'll have to wait till Tuesday to hear.
The only figure that I've seen has been around about 900 people tested. I'm making the assumption that it's positive and we haven't had any negative news. However, today will be a fairly big day for getting tests done.
Michael Healy admits Cairns has had a good run of avoiding a major COVID outbreak, but realises the city is now on a knife's edge with Delta.
It is inevitable, and I think we've only got to see that what's been happening has been this Delta variant, which is obviously far more infectious, which is means it's a greater danger to the community, and that's what we're seeing.
State Labor MP Michael Healy, our reporter there, Carly Williams. You're listening to PM on the radio, on the ABC Listen app and via the podcast. I'm Linda Mottram. Ahead, the Taliban take Kunduz, the 5th of Afghanistan's regional centres, to fall in just days. Preeminent Afghanistan expert William Maley joins me.
We're actually witnessing a situation in which modernists, moderates who actually believed Western claims about the superiority of democracy and pluralism and the importance of engagement with the world, have been in effect sold out. It's a horrifying situation.
New data reveals that only 14% of child sexual abuse claims before the family court are believed by judges to be true. Researchers have released the findings in a bid to prompt a discussion about whether Australia's legal system is equipped to deal with such allegations. Legal experts say abused children could be falling through the cracks, and they say consideration should be given to having a panel of experts to help investigate such cases. Helen Frost reports.
Family court cases and custody battles can be messy, challenging and extremely rough on everyone involved, particularly children. Jess Hill is an award-winning author who writes about domestic abuse. She says people frequently contact her for help navigating the system.
Nobody wins in the family law courts because the outcomes are always going to be out of the favour of at least one parent. If you were able to mediate and come to an agreed outcome, you wouldn't go to court.
Experts say one of the major issues is that allegations of sexual abuse that reach the family court are particularly challenging. Professor Patrick Parkinson from the University of Queensland here.
The cases which go to trial in the family court are the too hard basket of the child protection system. They're the cases where the police don't feel they're able to prosecute, the child protection authorities haven't reached a clear view of whether abuse has occurred, the alleged perpetrator hasn't just accepted that he won't be seeing his kids and dropped out of the process.
To try and provide more clarity, a group of four researchers from across Australia reviewed 7 years' worth of relevant cases from 2012 to 2019. They found that in just 14% of contested cases, judicial officers expressed a direct belief that allegations of child abuse were true, and risk of sexual harm to a child was found in 12% of cases. One of the report authors, Professor Laurie Maloney from La Trobe University's School of Psychology, says that on the surface, the data looks counterintuitive.
The key finding is really, on any kind of normal expectation, a very low level of findings of child sexual abuse, roughly just under two-thirds of what we call the allegedly unsafe parents, that is, the parents who had been alleged to abuse their children, had the time they spent with their children increased by the court.
Lisa Young, Professor of Law at the Murdoch School of Law and Criminology in Perth, says the system deals adequately with the small number of false allegations of sexual abuse, but she says it's not suitable for dealing with cases where it is likely sexual abuse has occurred.
We have a large grey area in the middle where it's uncertain what's happened, and yet there is no finding of a risk of abuse. That is the concern. It seems very, very likely there are children in that group who are not being protected.
The data shows just under half of sexual abuse allegations were regarded by judges to be genuinely believed by the parent alleging the abuse, but were believed to be mistaken by the court, while a quarter of allegations in contested hearings are believed to be deliberately misleading. The experts agree that the evidence before the courts is often ambiguous and more resources are required to determine if abuse has occurred. Professor Parkinson here.
It can be very, very costly to pursue an allegation in the family court, not just because of the legal costs, but because of the cost of the expert witnesses as well. And what the government could do to improve things greatly is to have a system by which the government paid for the investigation, just so that the states pay for child protection investigations in the state system.
Jess Hill suggests a panel of experts could assess claims.
These allegations could be better assessed in a triage process where you have two or three experts assessing this, rather than it just hinging on one person who may be a psychiatrist, a social worker, a psychologist, who does not have specific training in understanding domestic violence or child sexual abuse.
In response to the research, the family court issued a statement saying allegations of family violence, including child sexual abuse, are frequently raised but also denied in family law proceedings. Crucial to any decision is the need for the judge to make findings of fact based on evidence presented in each case as to whether or not alleged events occurred or whether there is an unacceptable risk.
Helen Frost with that report. Well, with the Taliban seizing five regional Afghan capitals in quick succession, one of the top observers of the country says that the US should target Pakistan as the main regional enabler of the militants. Pakistan's President Imran Khan has denied claims that they enable the Taliban, but Professor William Maley says the US should consider using its financial sanctions legislation or even listing Pakistan as a state sponsor of terrorism. William Maley is Professor Emeritus at the Australian National University, an expert in diplomacy, Afghanistan and refugees, of which there are likely to be a vast number more from Afghanistan as foreign forces complete their departure and the Taliban sweeps across the country. Professor Maley has been telling me Afghanistan is on the brink of disaster, largely because of the US deal with the Taliban agreeing to the Western withdrawal.
The two most significant elements of that were firstly the forced release by the Afghan government of 5,000 combat and political prisoners, which the Americans had promised to the Taliban even in the absence of the Afghan government. And that has re-equipped the Taliban with battle-hardened leaders who are now turning up in these particular theatres of operation. But on top of that, you have the psychological morale effect on the Afghan military and elements of the Afghan population more broadly, which is that when you feel that you have just been abandoned by your principal ally, essentially because it got bored, the danger is that you will feel a sense of utter despair and that increasingly you will see people who don't like the Taliban but want to save their skins cutting deals locally in the hope of getting a certain amount of local stability.
We'll talk a bit more about the politics in a minute, but in terms of the Afghan military's capability at this time, what are its strengths and what are its limitations?
The Afghan military has significant special forces who have been highly trained and who have proved effective, but they are spread too thinly at the moment. And it's pretty clear that the objective of the Taliban, and this has been predictable for months and months, has been to try to hit multiple targets at the one time in order to prevent the special forces from being able to eject them from any single place and consolidate hold over territory that's been regained. The military activities of the Taliban are exposing the relative weakness of the regular armed forces as opposed to the special forces. And of course, a lot of the recovery of territory has been dependent upon US air power, which the US are in a position to retract by the end of the month.
And we saw in the past few days the US deploying B-52s to bomb some Taliban positions. So clearly the US is activated by what's going on at the moment, but Joe Biden doesn't seem to be budging on the withdrawal. What more could he do? Do you think there will be a moment that will drive him to have to come back?
Well, he could, at a moment's notice, reverse course, but I don't see any likelihood of his doing that, partly because I think that a lot of what he's done is driven by domestic politics and a desire to show the military that now he's the boss. You also have a claim that public opinion in America is demanding a withdrawal. I think that's much more dubious because for those who can remember, for example, the Vietnam War, there's no evidence in America of the intensity of concerns about what's already a very small deployment in Afghanistan. The other thing that the Americans could do is put real pressure on Pakistan, which has been the critical supporter of the Taliban. We wouldn't be seeing what we're witnessing at the moment if it weren't for the sanctuaries, the logistical support, the ammunition, all the kinds of backing that Pakistan has been giving to the Taliban. But I think, again, the Americans have spent so long misunderstanding the situation and framing Pakistan as part of the solution rather than as part of the problem, that it would be cognitively difficult for them to make the kind of switch that would be required at this point to put effective diplomatic measures in place. There are all sorts of means that could be used, such as threatening Pakistan with blacklisting under the Financial Action Task Force sanctions regime, or threatening that Pakistan, if it continued to support the Taliban and accommodate its leadership, might be declared a state supporting terror. But frankly, I don't see the Biden administration doing that at the moment unless the situation deteriorates even further.
How are ordinary Afghans seeing this and feeling about this at the moment?
Well, we know from a very good Asia Foundation survey that was conducted in Afghanistan in 2019 that 85.1% of the population have no sympathy whatsoever for the Taliban. So we're actually witnessing a situation in which modernists moderates who actually believed Western claims about the superiority of democracy and pluralism and the importance of engagement with the world have been, in effect, sold out. It's a horrifying situation. What makes it worse is that there are plenty of observers in the United States who are watching this as if they were at a baseball match eating popcorn and soda pop rather than recognizing that there's a huge human disaster unfolding in front of our eyes, which really could end up like Cambodia in 1975.
William Maley, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And that Cambodia reference, between 1975 and 79, some 2 million people, nearly a quarter of Cambodia's population, died at the hands of the murderous Khmer Rouge. Professor William Maley, my guest there. More of his deeper insights at the PM webpage and on Twitter shortly. Well, that is PM for this Monday. I'm Linda Mottram. Thank you for listening. You can find us on the ABC Listen app, at the PM webpage indeed, or as a podcast. And another news podcast for you, check out The Signal weekday mornings there, along with one big deep analysis for you. We're back tomorrow with more PM. Hope you'll join us then. But now on RN, it's time for the Health Report. Here's Dr. Norman Swan.